Good afternoon. Another fact that I just wanted to share this before we get started, David and I were in school together at Faulkner University. There's several with connections to Faulkner University, and it's a blessing to be able to work with David again after all of these years. We are blessed at Lehman Avenue with a wonderful eldership that has changed in constitution over time, as is just typically the case through attrition of various things that come along. But it has continued to be, I don't know that it has ever been stronger, and we're blessed. The great things that are going on at Lehman, you would understand, certainly because of the God that we serve, that we're going to talk about in this session. But apart from that, Brother Dan Winkler's dad taught me in school, and he said, leadership is the crisis of our time, and we can't rise above the level of our leadership, and we're blessed tremendously. We are looking in these sessions at some studies that are to dig a little deeper for us to look at some of the themes that may be a part of our study in the Gospel of John that don't necessarily fall into some of the textual breaks that we're looking at in the auditorium. There are sessions that are focused on leadership and the needs that are specific there that John addresses, and then we're looking at how the book of John can help those who are preaching. Boy, the sermon material that can be found there, but also the principles from Jesus and from the disciples that we see. We have youth event lessons that focus on John, how John can help our youth and our women as well, and the rich studies that are already here that are going on there. But in these sessions, what we're going to do is to look at various things. We've already looked at the key words in the book of John. What we're going to do today is to look at the signs. And when we think about the signs that are apparent in John, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. I like a book, I recommend that to you, and that is Toward an Exegetical Theology. It's a book by Walter Kaiser. And Kaiser in that book talks about how that it is good and helpful for us to look at the details that make up a book, but we're looking at those details so that it can help us to see the big picture. And that being the case, it's important for us to see the threads, the cycles, the patterns that are apparent in a book that help us to see the big picture. It's Kaiser's way, I guess, of saying, let's don't take a text out of its context and make a pretext. We need to see the connections that the Holy Spirit inspired the writers to put in that. So that word context is a very important word to us. It's from two Latin elements, the word con, meaning together, and the word textus, meaning to weave. So if you think about that together, the confluence of a river, how rivers come together, textus or textiles. And so what we want to do as we walk through a book is to see what's the weaving that's to be done. You know, you look at the Bible as a whole, there's a thread that weaves throughout it, right? The salvation of man through Christ and the glory of God, a study of the scheme of redemption, shows us that wherever you're studying in the book, you're seeing that theme develop. That's because of the Spirit's guidance of those 40 men in writing those things. But what about when you come to a particular book of study? How is it that you can find the threads and thereby understand or appreciate the book better? So let's look at some examples of that. All right, we're going to look at the thread, the connections that tie the book of Genesis together. Is there something that can help us as we walk through that book? Those who have been studying the Lehman Learner with us may remember that's how we caption that. These are the generations. All right, the inspired writer Moses, as he walks through the book, he periodically gives us this statement, and every time he gives us a new section of material for us to study that helps him to develop his overall thing. All right, well then you look at other books. New Testament books do it as well. The book of Matthew helps us to understand and appreciate some of the various major elements and themes of it by showing us what Jesus taught. Remember, Matthew is to demonstrate the sovereignty of Jesus as the king that the Jews have been looking for. And so Matthew demonstrates, one of the ways he does that is through his teaching section. You'll walk through the book of Matthew and you'll see between the miracles and the visions and the dreams and the other ways that Matthew's fulfilling his theme, you will see him periodically teaching the people. And Matthew lets us know when we're hitting a hard stop. He'll say, when Jesus had finished these sayings. Now, interestingly, you want to know when you're at the end of the teaching sections, you go to Matthew 26 and verse 1. And Matthew says, when Jesus had finished all these things, he's done with the teaching section. All right, you get to the book of Ecclesiastes, another example. Four major sections in the book of Ecclesiastes. And at the end of every one of those sections, you'll have Solomon saying something like, eat, drink, and enjoy your work, for this is the gift of God. It's a great way for you to go from, to kind of pivot from one place to another, from one point to the next point. One more example of that is the book of Micah. In the book of Micah, there are three major sections, and each one begins with the word here. Chapter 1, verse 2, chapter 3, verse 1, and chapter 6, and verse 1. All right, so these can help us to appreciate the book better. You still want to go verse by verse, chapter by chapter, read through the entire book as a whole and to see what that book is telling us. But this is one of the ways you can do that. Now, when we look at how to analyze what a book is about, there are different ways to do that. One way to approach every book of the Bible and to understand it better is to count the keywords. This is not everything, but it's a helpful marker to see what is on the writer's mind. And so you will have a prevalence of words that will help you to appreciate. Another thing that's done to help us to know what a book is about is you'll see in New Testament books, particularly, petition verbs. And when you have particularly the predominant New Testament word is parakaleo, to call alongside, I beseech, I urge, I implore. Typically, if you find one of those in the book, it's very important to the overall purpose of that book. And then you look in the prayers. So often the writers are telling you in the prayers what it is that they're going to talk about, what's on their mind. If it's important enough for them to bow their knee to God and to talk to Him about it, it's important to the overall theme of the book. But one of the masterful ways, one of the easiest ways, we can see what a book is about is through purpose statements. There are several books that give us explicit purpose statements so that we can know what that book is about. One of those is the book of Ecclesiastes. After we see all those things under the sun, wherein Solomon does not find fulfillment in searching for what is not vanity, he says, finally, let us hear the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this applies to every man. Well, another example of that would be, for example, Luke chapter 1 and verse 4, where Luke is writing to Theophilus, and he says, I am writing so that you can have an exact knowledge of the things that you've been taught. And so walk through Luke and see if that's not the case. If he does not methodically lay down the things that he was taught that are really, you lay aside the book of Acts and you'll understand two books if you catch what he says in Luke 1 and verse 4. How about 1 John 1 and verse 4? These things we write so that our joy may be made complete. 1 Timothy 3:15, one of the most powerful purpose statements in the Bible. You have the Apostle Paul talking to his son in the faith who was preaching at Ephesus. And he says in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 15, I'm writing these things to you, hoping to come to you shortly. But if I'm delayed, I'm writing so that you ought to know how you should conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God. Purpose statements can be powerful. And I've said all of that to say, there is not a more powerful purpose statement than in the book of John. You get to John chapter 20. This has been referenced before, and I promise you I'm not the last time you're going to hear that this weekend because it's so crucial. John is writing there at the end, and he says these things, or many other signs rather, Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing you might have life in His name. So there's so much that comes out of that passage that's helpful to us, but for the purpose of this particular session, do you notice what he says? There were many other signs that Jesus did in the presence of the disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe. Now I know when I get there, having traveled all the way through the book, that the signs that appear are serving that purpose. I want you to think about this when it comes to signs. When we talk about signs, signs display God's glory. Signs are important. That word semeion, so we've already mentioned this, it's found 17 times in the book of John. It is that which reflects or magnifies or points to something of greater significance. Okay, so that sign may be or may not be miraculous in its nature. Now, typically in the book of John, it's going to be miraculous. But the miracle itself points to something bigger. And what the signs in the book of John are going to be pointing to is that Jesus is God's true representative. It's going to be pointing to the fact that Jesus is the Son of God. And that as the Son of God, he has the ability to produce life in those who believe. All right, so those signs, that word sign, actually can be used of a road sign or a sign on the side of a building. But it points to something else. Now, another word about signs. I know this is a very long introduction, but I won't take it out on you in the main points. Those will be a little bit briefer. When it comes to the signs, it is said that there are seven of them. All right, there are about 35 miracles of Jesus in the Gospels. John records 10 of those, around 10 of those. But you'll notice that there are seven signs. Generally, consensus agreement, seven signs. Now, why seven when there are 10 that are performed in the book? Well, these signs are public attestations, that is, public declarations. They are done in the sight of others so that people could see, and out of the seeing of that, believe, and that through believing might have life in his name. All right? But seven is a number of significance. John is Jewish. He's writing a universal gospel, but he's writing from the background of his own experience, his own education, and that which brought him to the point of the inspiration at the end of his life in writing this gospel. And so as he would point to seven, it would be complete. We have a complete number of signs that point to Jesus as God's true representative. Now, you've heard, haven't you, before you came into this classroom, there are seven signs. That's not something that's the first time you've heard, but here's something that was interesting to me in studying deeper. I guess I always had in my mind what they were. You realize that though it's agreed there's seven, it's not agreed to which seven are the seven? Do you know that? Now, six of them are. So these you can write in pen. The other one I suggest you might want to write in pencil, I guess. The first one is the turning of water into wine. John 2, 1 through 11. This is one of those instances where we don't have to guess because this is the first sign which Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. The second sign that is generally agreed upon, you would have to go over to chapter 4, verse 46 through 54. And this is the healing of the nobleman's son, the son who's at the point of death. And this, at the end of that text, in the beginning of that text, you have the indication that this is the second sign which Jesus did in Cana of Galilee. Third sign, because of various markers in the nature of them, that all are agreed upon is the healing of the lame man in chapter 5, verse 1 through 16. Fourth sign, about which everybody is in agreement, is the feeding of the 5,000 in John chapter 6, verse 1 through 15. You'll see, look at verse 2. Jesus is going to look back on that, and he says that you came to me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate the loaves and were filled, right? So he's pointing back to that sign. Then you have the healing of the blind man, John chapter 9, and the indication of the signs that are spoken of in that context. And then in John chapter 11, you have the sixth consensus sign, and that's the raising of Lazarus from the dead. 11:47, you see that they acknowledge, the crowd does, the signs that are done. John chapter 12 and verse 18, people are believing because they've seen the signs that Jesus did. And because of Lazarus being raised and among them, it was a sign that sat at that feast in John chapter 12 that everybody could see. Okay? I'm not the greatest mathematician, but I realize that leaves us with one. Would you believe that there are as many as 10 suggestions for that other sign? And there's some merit, perhaps, in all of them. There is the cleansing of the temple in John chapter 2. There is Jesus speaking to Nicodemus and saying, as the serpent was raised in the wilderness, so the Son of Man will be lifted up. That's the sign, some say. Some say it's the walking on the water, many say, in John chapter 6. There are those who would say that other remaining sign would be Mary anointing Jesus, or the triumphal entry, both in John chapter 12. Some say it's Jesus washing the disciples' feet in John chapter 13. There are those who would say that it's the thrusting of the spear in Jesus' side, out of which comes blood and water in John chapter 19. There are those who would say that it's the crucifixion and the resurrection, John 18 through 20. Some who would say that it's the resurrection appearances in John 20 and 21. And even some who would say that it's the miraculous catch of 153 fish by the disciples in John chapter 21. All of those are significant, if you will, out of our sight. And we'll talk about which one I think it is. I do want to share one thought that might be provocative. I think a strong case can be made for the crucifixion and the resurrection as a sign. I believe it's the ultimate sign. I believe that the other seven are pointing in that direction, but that this is what everything is building toward. This is why and how we know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing in Him will I have life in His name. But Mark Girard says, he sees this as a chiasm. Chiasm is this idea Hebrew writing, usually in the poetry sections, where the first and the last element correspond, and the second and the next to the last, all the way to the center. And then that central thing is the pivot of the chiasm. It's what the chiasm is all about. And so he would say that the first through the third signs that I mentioned to you, and the seventh through the fifth would correspond. And he would say that the middle sign is that Jesus is the bread of life, the feeding of the 5,000. And he says, because when this is done, by the way, it's recorded by all four of the gospel writers, the only miracle that is recorded by all of them, that they have the bread of earth and they have the bread of heaven, and you have Jesus calling himself the bread of life, and it is a line of demarcation, because after he's done this, you remember what John 6:66 through 69 say? Many of the disciples turned back and they followed him no more. Jesus turns to the 12 and he says, will you also go away? And Peter says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we believe and we're sure that you're the Holy One of God. Food for thought. I don't agree with it, but I think it's a good argument. So as we look at the signs, I want you to think about this. As we examine them, I want you to think about how these signs are the Father bearing witness that Jesus is His Son, His true representative, and He has come to bring something new. So when we think about how the Father does that, the Father gives testimony to Jesus as His Son through the words of Jesus. So as we examine the words that Jesus says, He says that these words that I have are not mine, but my Father's who gave them to me. John chapter 7 and verse 16, He's going to say something similar. In John chapter 8 and verse 28, in John chapter 12 and verse 49, in John chapter 17 in His prayer, in verse 8 and verse 14. And then there's the I Am statements, where Jesus is attesting of Himself, I am, I'm deity. And through that, He is reflecting who He is and teaching so that people will believe, and believing have life in His name. But the Father's also given testimony to who Jesus is through the works of Jesus. And it's the works of Jesus that point us to the signs. I know I'm halfway there. Let's get to the main points here. Let's go through seven signs very quickly, okay? And see what they signify. The first thing we see is the water to wine. And the water to wine signifies, as we see there, a new order. In chapter 2, verse 1 through 12, there is a new order that Jesus has come to bring. For us to appreciate this first sign, we've got to go back to John chapter 1. In John chapter 1, we see that the law came by Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. God has been communicating His will throughout time up to this point. He spoke to the fathers in time past through the prophets, Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 1. Isn't it interesting that John the Apostle begins by talking about John the Baptist, this prophet who comes and speaks, John chapter 1 and verse 6. And so God has been testifying through the word of others who He has sent, what His will was, what His message was, but now God has come in the flesh, John chapter 1 and verse 14, and He, as He comes to demonstrate to us that He is God's final message. That's Hebrews 1 and verse 1. That's what the book of John is telling us, and that's what I believe the first sign is signifying to us. Think about what happens on this occasion. You have the wedding feast at Cana, and you have those jars of purification, and what Judaism is doing through those jars of water, Jesus is taking and making or transforming it into something that really meets needs. Think about how Judaism can be contrasted with what Jesus comes to bring. Jesus is going to take Judaism, or what's in the law, that schoolmaster that's meant to bring us to Christ, according to Galatians chapter 3, and he is going to transform it into something which everybody needs. You think about what he gives something that is completely new and different. Think about how powerful this miracle is. He takes H2O, that's what's in those jars, and he transforms them into something completely different molecularly. It does have water in it, but what else does it have? Glucose and fructose and tartaric acid and amino acids and carbon dioxide. And through this, he is showing, I've come to bring something new. There's a new order. And so what do we find happening right after this? Jesus is speaking to Nicodemus. And he is walking with him, this teacher of the law. He tells him, you've got to be born of water and of the Spirit. Something different as he comes to Jesus to find out what this teacher come from God has to say. John 3, verse 5 through verse 8. What do you think about when Jesus speaks to the woman at the well and he offers her living water? John chapter 4 and verse 14. Jesus has come to bring something new, a new order. Judaism has served its purpose. It led the people of God. It kept them together. It brought the Messiah into the world. But now Jesus is going to be focused on more than one portion of the people, but is going to be that which is needful to everybody. A lot more we can say about that, but I want us to move on. I believe the cleansing of the temple is a sign. I believe it's a sign for a couple of reasons. I think it's a sign because it's mentioned, the word signs, twice in that context. And I want you to see that it signifies a new authority. When folks come to Jerusalem, they're coming from all over Palestine. Now, some might be blessed to live in Jerusalem, but a great many people are having to come from greater distances, from Dan to Beersheba and points east and west. And so the difficulty of trying to walk by foot and bring those animals to the temple would have been very difficult. And so they created a system to offset that problem. They would sell you what you needed to worship God when you got there. I think it's a good idea in principle, but of course it was abused. And Jesus saw what they had done with the requirements of the law, how they had corrupted that, how they had missed the point. Jesus later, remember in John 4, 24, is going to speak to the Samaritan woman at the well, and he's going to say that hour is coming when neither in these mountains or in Jerusalem will you worship the Father, for the Father seeks those to worship him in spirit and truth. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. Jesus comes in, and he cleanses the temple of the money changers, the corruption he condemns. You remember verse 18, some of the Jews didn't like that? And they pushed back on that, and they asked him, what sign, what attesting miracle do you do that confirms your authority to do this? And John 2:23 says that individuals who saw these signs were believing on him. Now, the book of John can be divided into two sections. And it's done various ways, but I believe if you want to divide it down the middle, the first section would be called the book of signs. So that's another reason why I think we find our signs all here in John 2 through 12. In the resurrection is the ultimate sign. So you have the public ministry in which Jesus is doing the signs. You have the book of signs. And then in the second half of the book, you have the book of glory, the book of exaltation, the book of passion. This is where Jesus goes into his private discourse and he prays to his Father. And then you have the crucifixion, the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Christ. And so Jesus comes in this first section and he speaks to them about the authority that he has to do this. They said, what sign will you show us? And he says, destroy this temple, this body, and I will raise it in 3 days. Folks didn't really understand what was going on, but when Jesus was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered these things, and they believed. So you have this sign that Jesus is showing to point to a new authority. He has the authority to go in and to do this because of who he is. And this sign demonstrates that. I want you to walk through the book of John and see how it establishes Jesus' authority repeatedly. To those, he gave the right to be called the children of God, even as many as believe on his name. John chapter 1 and verse 12. John chapter 5 and verse 27, the Father gives authority to the Son. Or how about John 10 and verse 17 and 18? He says he lays down his life of his own initiative. He says the Father's given me the power to lay that down and to raise it up again. Or how about in John 19, Jesus is about to go to the cross, and Pilate is interrogating Jesus. And he says, "You're not going to answer me anything? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you or the power to set you free?" And Jesus said, "You have no power over me at all unless it was given to you from above." I think that this sign is a sign, rather. It is pointing, it is attesting to something of greater significance, and that is he had the right, because he's God's true representative, he is shining the Father's glory, to come in and do that, to restore the heart of God's desire for worship. I'll say more about that, but let's look at that third sign. The healing of the nobleman's son signifies new life. When we get to John chapter 4, and by the way, it's interesting, some have called this the Cana cycle. You see intent and organization with Jesus. He starts in John chapter 2 in Cana. He does that sign. He goes down to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and now he's back in Cana of Galilee. He's methodical. There's a method to the madness, and there's a motivation for this, and that is to show his glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. When we get here, we see that Jesus is a bit disappointed in the one in this sign and the next sign. He comes back to Cana of Galilee, and the nobleman's son comes up to him and tells him that his son is at the point of death. Do you see what Jesus says in reply to that in verse 48? He says, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you simply will not believe." Catch signs and faith and how they will be appearing together all throughout the book of John. Now, even though that's in the plural, "you people," he feels the need to reply, and he says, "Sir, come before my child dies." Jesus has compassion on him. And in his compassion, he says, "Go, your son lives." And this is where we see this man really being healed. Because at the word of Jesus, he goes off, and he accepts that that is the case. And it's interesting how the next day, when he meets his slave after a long journey back from here, that he gets the word from his slave that his son is alive. And he asked when it happened, and he said it was at the seventh hour, the day before, at the very time that he was told that his son lives. And that's when they really become noble, he and his household, because they believe. Verse 54. You see here this idea of life, that Jesus says the Father has the right of life. He says, and he has given to the Son the ability to give life. Here is a child whose life lay in the balance and was about to die. And so no wonder Jesus is proclaimed as the one who was the life. And in him was the life of the world. And you see this emphasis on life as you march throughout the book of John. But here's for the first time you see something else. For the first time, you see faith demonstrated without the immediacy of sight. Here is the nobleman in Cana of Galilee who's told his son lives. He believes it. He goes home. He hasn't seen his boy. He doesn't know what's going to happen there, but he believes, and he goes home, and guess what? It's validated. He's alive. We're going to see that theme again, aren't we, later? We're going to see the blind man who is the one who comes, and he says, up till then, it's not that we thought, seeing is believing, but for him, believing was seeing, in literal case. What about Thomas? Right before our purpose statement, to whom Jesus says, "Because you have seen, have you believed? Blessed are those who have not seen, yet who do believe." When we look at what's happening here in these signs, we see that the healing of the nobleman's son is an indication of new life. He has the power to give life because of who he is. Then we see the next symbol, the sign, and that is the healing of the lame man. And this signifies new judgment. In John chapter 5, we see Jesus going to the pool of Bethesda. And as we see him there, we see him coming up to a man who's had an ailment for 38 years. And something about the ailment kept him from being able to walk. And Jesus asked the man, "Do you want to be well?" And the man, and of course it depends on the translation that you have. Sometimes there's a broader explanation, but even without the explanation, we see that he needed somebody to take him down because the waters were stirred and there would be a healing anticipated. But he says, "Whenever I try to do that, somebody goes before me, and I don't have that opportunity." Jesus says, "Get up, pick up your pallet, and walk." And he immediately was well. And he picks up his pallet and he begins to walk. Now, I want you to think for just a moment about the contrast between this side and the side of the Lord. When you look at the nobleman and you look at this particular case, in the case of the nobleman, it was done privately. Word got out publicly. That's why it's one of the book of signs, one of the public signs. But here with the lame man, it's done publicly. And what's done with the nobleman's son is that which generates faith. But here we see that it's done even with the benefit of the man believing. The lame man is not overtly demonstrating faith. In the case of the nobleman's son, there's no mention of sin. But in the case of the lame man, there is an indication of sin. When we see what Jesus is doing here, we see him showing this man that the power to heal is in him. And out of that is a demonstration of his ability to judge. We'll see that in what he says right after this miracle. Because he not only talks about life, he talks about judgment. And how he has the right, the ability to judge. If he can heal a layman, you remember what happens? This happens on the Sabbath day. He picks up his pallet and he comes across the Pharisees. And remarkably, they look past the fact that here's a man who has been lame for 38 years. And all they get out of that is that he's working, according to their laws, their traditions, on the Sabbath day. They can look and see that this man must not be from God, according to their viewpoint, and look past the fact that he had the power to heal. Jesus comes back in verse 14, and he says, "You're well." He says, "But don't sin so that something worse can happen." He's not saying that sin caused this condition. We don't know what put this man in this condition, but we remember later on with the blind man in John chapter 9, the disciples say, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" Jesus said, "Neither one." This is so that the glory of God can be manifested in him. He is saying, you need to turn away from sin because there are things that are worse than being lame for 38 years. And Jesus talks about judgment. As the Father has the right of judgment, what does he say in John 5? "Marvel not at this. For the hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, they that have done evil unto the resurrection of condemnation." As the Father has that right, he's given that right to his Son. John chapter 5, verse 26 through verse 29. And so as he heals on this occasion the lame man, he is signifying the new judgment. Then we see that the feeding of the 5,000 signifies a new sustenance. This is that miracle that's recorded by all of the gospel writers. It is the filling of the 5,000 with the 5 loaves and 2 fish. So to set the stage, here is Jesus who goes to the southwest of the Sea of Galilee, down in that corner of the sea, to Tiberias. And he feeds those folks miraculously. And they had heard about the signs that he has performed in chapter 4 and chapter 5. Look at John 6 in verse 2. And Jesus afterwards goes across on the water. He walks on the water as a part of that. He goes back over to the east, northeast side of the Sea of Galilee. And the folks in his adopted hometown of Capernaum, they want a meal just like their neighbors down in Tiberias had gotten. And Jesus says they have a tremendous interest in his works, but an incredible disinterest in his words. You just want your bellies filled. You don't want the thing of greater significance that I've come to bring. You know, 3 times Jesus calls himself the bread of life, and he says the bread of life has come into this world to give us life for the world, John chapter 6 and verse 51. And in all of these, if we've not taken the time to show the contrast, I would encourage you to do this. See how Judaism is only a symbolic or a superficial supplier of things as compared to Jesus Christ. You have the bread come down from heaven, the manna from above, compared with the bread of life. Jesus is better than the Passover bread. He signifies that which is new. But then we also have the healing of the blind man that signifies new sight. We see this in John chapter 9. There's a bit of time between the fifth sign and the sixth sign. And there's a debate raging in chapter 7 and chapter 8 about who Jesus is. You look in John chapter 7 and verse 31, and the people say that no one's going to come who's going to do more signs than the Messiah this man is doing, the Messiah that we're waiting on. Could they do more signs than this? And we see in verse 43 that there's a division between the people from the leadership down to the common man. And meanwhile, Jesus comes along and he heals this man who was born blind. There are four groups in this particular text. You have the man's neighbors, you have the Pharisees, you have the man's parents, and you have the one born blind. Almost all of those could physically see, but they were spiritually blind. And here's this man, and even though he is physically blind, he can see. You see, what Jesus is saying is that you cannot be acceptable to God if you call Jesus a sinner. Look at verse 24. And he says, the blind man says, even at the threat of losing his place in the temple, he says, has it ever been known since the beginning of the world that one could help a man to see who was born blind? If this man had not come from God, he could do nothing. So here's a man who couldn't see, who has his sight restored to him. And out of this, he recognized he could see what even religious leaders, who should have been able to see better than anybody, could not see. Here's another interesting thing you might not have known, because this is taking place at the Feast of Tabernacles, that there is a ceremony that takes place under the old law in which four large oil-filled lamps were lit during this feast. It was in the court of women. 75-foot candelabras or candlesticks that were lit to commemorate the guidance of God with the pillar of fire in the wilderness journey. And it was said that it was so bright that it could light the entire city. And here is Jesus who comes along, and this is for a commemoration of a certain people and a certain event. And what does he say in John 8, verse 12? I am the light of the world, not just of one people. You see, if you believe in me, you'll not walk in darkness, but you'll have the light of life. So we have Jesus with this particular sign pointing to the glory of the fact that he brings new sight. And then, of course, we have raising of Lazarus. That signifies a new resurrection. We keep in mind that there have been other raisings from the dead. Elijah comes along and he raises from the dead the widow of Zarephath's son. Elisha comes along and heals the Shunammite woman's son. What happens with them? They die. But Jesus is the first fruits of them that sleep, 1 Corinthians 15:20. And through him comes the ultimate victory, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 57. Jesus raises Lazarus. But you know what's going to happen eventually to Lazarus? He's going to die again. On their tomb, there's going to be etched in two dates of death. What about Jesus? He's on his way to the cross. And when he dies, and when he comes out of that grave, there's not going to be a second date of death etched on his tomb. He says, I'm the first and the last and the living. And I was dead. And behold, I'm alive forevermore. And I have the power or the keys of death and Hades. We have something different. Jesus is pointing ahead to the raising of Lazarus. He's pointing ahead to himself and the fact that he is going to die, be raised, and defeat death through his resurrection. It's where it's all pointing to. So we get to the end of the book of signs, and we see in Jesus a steady march from here all the way to Calvary. John 11 and verse 47, people are seeing the signs, and they're trying to figure out. John chapter 12 tells us people seeing the signs in Jerusalem, they're believing in him. In John chapter 12 and verse 18, the great many of them, well, in John 11, 47, when the religious leaders see that, it doesn't cause them to believe, it makes them want to kill him. John 12 and verse 37, I believe it is, where we see that all the many signs that Jesus did despite them, they would not believe. What's our purpose statement? Many other signs truly did Jesus in the midst of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you might believe, and that in believing you might have life in his name. The signs were significant enough, they were numerous enough, that if people were disposed to believe, but they were going to believe, unlikely folks do, and folks you thought that would, did not. You know, if one apple falls from one tree, maybe that's not enough to prove the law of gravity, but you don't have to see every apple fall everywhere in order to believe that that law is in effect. John 21, 25 says, it's not possible for us to have a record of everything that Jesus did, including the signs, but he begins, he continues, and he ends the gospel, particularly the book of signs, demonstrating through those things the newness that he came to bring. And when he came up out of the tomb, it was the ultimate sign, the sign that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. The question is, we take with that, we believe in that, and accept the life that he offers. In his name.